Hello, welcome to Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Strangini. We are in the book of Genesis, chapter 24, verse 1. And Abraham was old and well stricken in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. Verse 2. And Abraham said unto his eldest servant of his house, that ruled over all that he had, Put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and I will make thee swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. Verse 4, But thou shalt go unto my country and to my kindred and take a wife unto my son Isaac. So, we're going to concern ourselves with the finding of a wife for Isaac, the promised son. You know, the finding of a wife is an extremely important thing if you have sons. In our modern culture, we don't consider it really the parent's business. A parent should always care about who their child marries. If they care about the welfare of their child, of their son or daughter, who they marry is important. But a lot of times, this is left up in this day and age, it's left up to the child or to the adult. Son or daughter, put it that way. I don't think of my adult children as children anymore, but what reason do I have for confidence that they know what they're doing? Well, if I have any confidence in what my children do, it's because I've taught them. In the modern age, if you aren't going to arrange your child's marriage, you definitely should arrange for your child to know what marriage is about, and the kind of spouse they should be looking for. You know, I don't like to throw family members under the bus, so to speak. But I will a little bit, and it's in love. My father did not come from a religious background. And so when he found faith in his 30s, and he became a zealous Christian, you know, he came from a very sinful lifestyle, to realizing that there was a standard that God had for us, that we should live our lives morally, and that, you know, chasing women and being promiscuous was unacceptable. When I was a child, though, he didn't really understand. He came from one end of the pendulum, totally ungodly, and he swung all the way to the other end. And basically, the instruction I got as a young man was, women are evil. You should stay away from women. And I think it was half a joke, you know. But as a child, I kind of took it seriously. At least serious that they seriously didn't want me even thinking about women. And I think that was unfortunate because young, healthy, normal men are going to think about women. They're going to be interested in women. They're going to have confusing thoughts. And the parents should fill in that blank because they don't know anything. And so, you know, that's the way I went about it with my kids. Now, in my own case, fortunately, the Lord made me a little clever. So when I was in my 20s, I realized something that we're going to see here, and I guess I'll hold off. Well, you can see the thought already in verse 3, but let's talk about verse 2 first. And then we'll talk about that. He says, put your hand under my thigh. And I was like, what's that mean? You know, and the first thing that came to my mind was like that it's some sort of put your hand under my testicles. And that they put the thigh as a euphemism for that. And then I was like, well, that, you know, Paul, maybe it's just your messed up mind. But my notes actually say that's kind of the idea. That the thigh is put for the organs of generation. It's kind of close there, right? Under my thigh, you're getting close to the truth. Now, that doesn't mean he would actually do it. Because according to some Jewish tradition, And also Indian customs, meaning, you know, East Indian, in India, according to their customs, they would place for a token of subjection, they would place their hand upon the thigh, like upon the leg, would be a form of subjection and of obeisance. So this definitely makes sense in that sense, because he's concerned about his son. And he's saying, swear on my organs of generation that you will do what I ask. I'm going to make you swear by God on my flesh that you will not take a wife for my son from these Canaanites. And that was something when I was about 19, 20, I realized that I should not take me a wife of these Canaanites. And so I developed a very specific idea about how I would go about dating. And it was basically that I realized that I could fall in love easily with the wrong person. And the way dating goes, there's a high probability that you could fall in love with the wrong person. You never start off talking about big, important issues. Like if you're on a first date with somebody and you say to them, how many kids do you want to have? Whoa, aren't you going a little fast? It's like, no. Because if this is a deal breaker, I don't want to take the risk of falling in love with you if I find out there's some fundamental difference of what I want out of life. And obviously, it's not necessarily that. Maybe you don't care much about kids. So maybe that's not a question. But you might want to know if they do. If they care a lot about kids, that may be a deal breaker for you. How they feel about the Lord. You know. So I realized that most people are kind of like, they start dating trying to figure out, like, oh, what's this person like? And they try to feel it out this really awkward way. Where I realized I needed to cut to the chase and eliminate them from consideration as quickly as possible based on broad categories. I would develop broad categories of what was unacceptable, and then I could, within moments, decide whether or not I should even date this person. Now, I imagined I would do this on a date, but honestly, this should be done in a phone call or a conversation. Fortunately, today you have these like matchmaking services, and I think those services actually tend to do a lot of that for you. I don't actually know a lot about it, but I'm assuming you tell them what your passions are, what you care about or whatever, and what your personality is, and they'll give you a scientifically chosen possibilities, okay? And maybe that works for some people. I've met people who it worked for who seemed very pleased about the match they were given, so, you know, maybe it does. But if you're not going to go through that, you need to be careful about who you think about, who you're hanging around with that could potentially become a mate. Because every dating partner is a potential future mate. You don't know it yet. Unless you just are sure you're not going to get married or something, you know. I mean, people who think they're sure very frequently find out that they weren't as sure as they thought they were, you know. There's like, oh, there's no way I'll get married. And then pretty soon they're walking down the aisle because of pressure, because there's all kinds of things that come to bear against you to make you conform to what people think you ought to do. That's why I'm not a big fan of dating per se. I mean, I don't mind people going out on dates, but like having this sort of incremental relationship where you get, where you start off in ignorance and you just kind of see if you're attracted and compatible. It's brain dead. It's completely brain dead. Before you even consider wasting your time with somebody, you should find out like that if you fell in love with them, if you found that you really liked them a lot, would they be a compatible marriage partner? And there's nothing wrong with asking those questions. You should be asking those questions, man or woman. I always have my mind on the male, though, because one, I'm a man, and two, I have 7 sons. So these are important questions. If I'm not going to choose your bride for you, I got to teach you how to choose. Now, Abraham didn't bother with this nonsense. He went right out and picked her out himself. He already knew he's not going to take a bride from these Canaanites. Now, whatever you may think about those prejudices and all that, prejudice is good, you know? And I'm not talking necessarily about racial prejudice. I'm just talking about having an idea about something when you've learned something. Having a preconceived notion, like, I want to have children. Let's say you want to have children. Say, I want to have like 4 or 5 children. I really want a big family. That's a prejudice. You've already judged ahead of time that you'd like that. You don't have a lot of children, so you don't know. But you've decided you want to try that. Prejudicially ruling out women who don't want kids or who are more career-oriented is not bad. It's smart. You're doing them a favor, and you're doing yourself a favor. You know, people forget that there's other kinds of prejudice than the, you know, the kind that people think is socially unacceptable, where you're just looking at the outward appearance of somebody or their racial makeup, and you say, I don't like them. You know, we always think of all prejudice as racial prejudice. But there's a lot of prejudice that's important and good, because you're being true to what you are and to the things you care about and to the values you have. You have values, that's prejudice to someone who doesn't value the same things. And that may not be, you know, maybe you've considered all sides. You know, maybe you've considered, oh, life with children, life without children. Maybe it's not, you know, like you just came to a prejudicial judgment without any consideration. But to someone else, they may view it as prejudice. You're prejudiced against people who don't want children. And you want so many children, but you're prejudiced. You won't date anyone who doesn't want children. What's wrong with you? Why are you so prejudiced? Maybe because you're thinking. And you know that if you want children and they don't, that that may not make a happy marriage. And so Abraham knows his son, what he's raised, the kind of son he's raised. And he's helping out by saying, you will not find him a bride of the Canaanites. I'm not going to settle for that. At this time, there wasn't dating and all this stuff. They lived in their little community and there were women around, and Abraham was protecting him from them. They were idolatrous. They were unacceptable. He was looking at the Canaanite culture. If you marry a Canaanite woman and you're living in the land of Canaanites, what happens to you? You become a Canaanite. You become a Canaanite and your children become Canaanites, and you become absorbed and assimilated into their civilization. Abraham knows something, and he's going to talk about it, that means that he should not allow that to happen. He's like, you got to take one of my kindred. That will ensure the separation between my family and the people who live here. Verse 5. And the servant said unto him, peradventure the woman will not be willing to follow me unto this land. Must I needs bring thy son again into the land from whence thou camest? So what if she won't come? Maybe I'll need to bring Isaac over there. Is that going to happen? And Abraham said unto him, beware that thou bring not my son thither again. No. The Lord God of heaven, which took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and which spake unto me and that swear unto me, saying, unto thy seed will I give this land, he shall send his angel before thee, and thou shalt take a wife unto my son from thence. What he's saying is, God's going to show you the way, and you're going to bring me a wife from there to here. And if the woman will not be willing to follow thee, then thou shalt be clear from this, my oath. Only bring not my son thither again. You will not bring him there. I would sooner have him find no wife at all than you would bring him a wife of the Canaanites, or that you would bring him back to where I came out of. Verse 9. And the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him on that matter. Very delicate matter. So it's sworn upon a very delicate place. Verse 10. And the servant took 10 camels of the camels of his master and departed, for all the goods of his master were in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia unto the city of Nahor. This servant is a very high-ranking servant in Abraham's household, and he can take as many of the camels as he wants. You know, he took 10. That's what he chose. I'll take 10 camels to make a good whatever, to make a good show of it, or just there's some purpose, or God has led him in this regard. Why 10? I don't know, but he knew. So he goes to Mesopotamia, the land between the river Tigris and Euphrates. And he made his camels to kneel down without the city by a well of water at the time of evening. and the time that women go out to draw water. There's a particular time when women go out to draw water. It was part of the daily routine. Verse 12, and he said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day, and show kindness unto my master Abraham. So he prays to God on behalf of his master. Again, does this servant, you know, when we get a weird picture about slavery in the Bible, we're talking about a different animal. This is not the antediluvian South. This is the Bronze Age. Different world. This man is freely praying for his master, who is very good to him. It's kind of like having a job, like a permanent job, like job security. You know, people want job security and stuff. I mean, I have no doubt that he could get out of this job. But while he's doing it, he is absolutely, you know, he's got to do what Abraham says, or just you can't have this position. A lot of the servitude in the Bible is more like a form of employment. That's why the biblical fugitive slave law. Deuteronomy 23, verse 15. I write it down on the back of my Bible a long time ago. Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee. He shall dwell with thee, even among you in that place. You don't return someone who runs away from their servitude. You don't send them back, period. That's the law in the Bible. That wasn't the law in America. So that was not a biblical doctrine of slavery we had going here. We had something a lot more dirty. Something justifiably called evil. But don't conflate that with what you read in the Bible. It's very different. Verse 13. Behold, I stand here by the well of water, and the daughters of the men of the city came out to draw water. Come out to draw water. Okay. Verse 14. And let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I shall say, let down thy pitcher, I pray thee, that I may drink. And she shall say, drink, and I will give thy camels drink also. Let the same be she that thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. And thereby shall I know that thou hast showed kindness unto my master. So here's his plan. He got 10 camels. He's formulated this idea. How am I going to know the woman? Well, he's formulated a kind of test. It'd be easy to do a test like, well, you know, I'll flip a coin and at each woman I see and the first one that comes up heads, that's her. That's a terrible test. This is a test that is highly likely to fail. Meaning, if someone's coming out to draw water, that means that they're in the middle of doing chores. You say, could I have something to drink? Now, a lot of people will give you a drink, right? They'll give you a drink. Sure. You know, that's common kindness, even in the Bronze Age. But to then offer voluntarily to water your 10 camels, that's a lot of drawing of water. And camels drink a lot. So he knows that he is putting out a very unlikely scenario. And so he's figuring, this is how I'm going to discern God's will when something extremely unlikely happens. And I've seen that happen where the unlikely thing, you know, makes people feel like God is in it because it's unlikely. You know, when I was formulating the idea of how I was going to go about finding a bride, because I knew I wanted to be married when I was 20, I knew it. That's what I wanted. I wanted a wife, but I didn't want to mess around with all the wrong women. So I was going to ask them questions and probe. And I thought it was going to have to all be up to me. But really, in the end, it was kind of the opposite. As the Lord brought a woman to me who asked me all kinds of questions and probed me. But thereby, I knew that she was the right one by the questions she asked. I mean, like me going and asking someone questions like, do you believe in God? And all these things. It can be very easy for them to, like, let's say, you know, I had family members who were lining up dates for me. Because they knew I wanted to find somebody. And they said, well, I've been showing your picture around and there's some girls that are interested. And they're lining them up for me to talk to. But if they looked at me and thought I was like some person that they wanted to be with, they could answer misleadingly, you know, feign interest in certain subjects and kind of manipulate me perhaps. I didn't think that was going to happen because I was going to be pretty straightforward and brutal about it. But I never ended up following up on that plan because I met my wife before I even got to put her into execution. She came to me. She posed the questions to me. She showed all her interest in the things I was concerned about by showing interest without being asked, are you interested in this? I was like, are you really interested? How interested are you in the Bible? Well, you know, blah, blah, blah. No. What does this mean? What does that mean? It was very probing. She was very obviously interested. And also into a high degree. Not because she was interested in me, but because, not as like a husband or something, but because she saw me as a source of information. She was interested in the knowledge I possessed in the scriptures, first and foremost. And that's what I wanted, someone who was interested in the scriptures first and foremost, not in me. And that became a very interesting person to me. So I did not plot that unlikely scenario where I would accidentally meet somebody who would, instead of having to be asked the questions, would ask me the questions I was going to ask. Maybe not the precise questions, but you understand what I'm saying. Like, the situation got reversed on me. The servant of Abraham has already thought all this out. I'm going to say, give me a drink, and she's going to say, yeah, and I'll do your camels also, 10 of them. I'll water them all. And I'll know that you're really looking after Abraham, because not only is that a sign, but that's a heck of a woman. You know, they would be not only kind to this man, but kind to his animals. And doing him a favor, no doubt, in watering his animals. But people that are kind to animals, it's always a good sign. Someone who's like afraid of work, it's not such a great sign. Verse 15. And it came to pass, before he had done speaking, that behold, Rebekah came out, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, with her pitcher upon her shoulder. So she comes. So he's just finishing up this. He's not even done. As he's saying it, she's walking out. Verse 16. And the damsel was very fair to look upon, a virgin, neither had any man known her. And she went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came up. This is the kind of well where you actually walk downstairs into it and fill it. So it's not just a rope with a bucket. You got to walk down the stairs to the reservoir and walk back up with the pitcher. How big is the pitcher? I'm guessing it's going to be at least 30 pounds. Otherwise, what's the value? Why would you go, you know, so infrequently? 30 pounds would be like, you know, 3 gallons. Something. It's going to be at least 3 gallons. I don't know. How big were these pitchers? I'm guessing it's not so easy. When it says she's a virgin, neither had any man lain with her. That shows you that the word virgin has a different meaning here. It means a young maiden. She was young and a virgin, as we, in our technical sense of the word, meaning no man had ever known her sexually. That kind of virgin also. She was a maiden and a virgin. And the servant ran to meet her and said, let me, I pray thee, drink a little water of thy pitcher. So she's come up with the water, and he's saying, can I have a little of your water? And she said, drink, my lord. And she hasted and let down her pitcher upon her head and gave him drink. And when she had done giving him drink, she said, I will draw water for thy camels also until they have done drinking. So she's gone even farther. In a sense, she has exceeded his expectations. He was just saying, I will water your camels. Well, you know, you can give them so much water, but like I said, camels can drink a lot. And she's saying, I'll give your camels water till they're done. He's just coming off of a journey from Canaan to Mesopotamia. Verse 20, and she hasted and emptied her pitcher into the trough and ran again into the well to draw water and drew for all his camels. And the man, wondering at her, held his peace, to wit, whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not. Meaning, to wit, to know. To know whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not. He held his peace. He's watching her. He's like, this is it. He wants to see if the one more, what's the one more thing, right? Will you come? What if she won't come? He was worried about that. So now he's found the woman, and now he wants to know. He really wants to know if this is it. Verse 22, and you can see there's a lot of eagerness in this. And it came to pass, as the camels had done drinking, that the man took a golden earring of half a shekel weight, and two bracelets for her hands of 10 shekels weight of gold, and said, Whose daughter art thou? Tell me, I pray thee, is there room in thy father's house for us to lodge in? Verse 24. And she said unto him, now he asked that question, of course, to inquire, what people are you? Because he wouldn't want to go all the way to Mesopotamia and find out that she's also a Canaanite girl, visiting, visiting from Canaan or whatever. But she answers and says unto him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, which she bare unto Nahor. And she said moreover unto him, We have both straw and provender enough and room to lodge in. So we have a place for your camels and a place for you. Verse 26, And the man bowed down his head and worshiped the Lord. Very happy at the way things are going. This is a journey he undertook with a lot of uncertainty. Verse 27, And he said, Blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who hath not left destitute my master of his mercy and his truth. I being in the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren. Well, the language there is a little weird, but you get the gist of it. That God has not left Abraham out when it concerns mercy and truth. I being in the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren. I guess he's just saying he sees God's path and he has been brought to the place that Abraham wanted him to go, to the house of his brethren, his kinsmen, people who are like him. You know, if you want your children to grow up like you, you need to, if you want your grandchildren, then you have to raise your children so that they will marry into the same culture that you come from. Because you can quickly become another type of people with different values and different outcomes, different lives. Verse 28. And the damsel ran and told them of her mother's house these things. So she went and told the people of the mother's household these things. Verse 29. And Rebekah had a brother, and his name was Laban. And Laban ran out unto the man, unto the well. And it came to pass, when he saw the earrings and bracelets upon his sister's hands, and when he heard the words of Rebekah his sister, saying, Thus spake the man unto me, that he came unto the man, and behold, he stood by the camels at the well. And he said, Come in, thou blessed of the Lord, wherefore standest thou without? For I have prepared the house and room for the camels. Verse 32, And the man came unto the house, into the house, and he ungirdled his camels, and gave straw and provender for the camels, and water to wash his feet, and the men's feet that were with him. He did not undertake this journey alone. He had 10 camels and probably men on the camels, because you don't just wander off alone in the Bronze Age necessarily. It was a fairly peaceful time, but it's always good to go about in a group. 33. And there was set meat before him to eat, food. But he said, I will not eat until I have told mine errand. And he said, Speak on. 34. And he said, I am Abraham's servant. And the Lord hath blessed my master greatly, and he has become great. See, he doesn't want to eat first. This is something you got it. When you're talking like this, some people might think it's good to eat and then broach these subjects, but this is the kind of thing you should go over first. It's like I said, people always think, well, let's just sit down, let's get to know each other, and then we'll talk about the serious stuff. Before I sit down and get to know you, I want to tell you why I'm here. I think that's how you should approach dating. This is why I'm here. Why am I dating you? I don't want to just have, I'm not looking for a 6-month relationship. If that's what you're looking for, then we're already in the wrong, we're wasting both of our time here. If you're looking for a 6-month relationship, then I'm not your guy. That's what you need to be thinking. Why anyone would want to go through all those twists and turns is beyond me. You'd be better off not going through it at all. So he's going to broach the important business before he sits down and eats these people's food. Because he's brought gold and stuff, but there's reasons. He's got important things to discuss. Verse 34, and he said, I am Abraham's servant, and the Lord hath blessed my master greatly, and he has become great, and he hath given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and men servants and maid servants and camels and asses. And Sarah, my master's wife, bare a son to my master when she was old, and unto him hath he given all that he hath. And my master made me swear, saying, Thou shalt not take a wife to my son of the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I dwell. But thou shalt go into my father's house and to my kindred and take a wife unto my son. This is recapitulation. We know this, but he's got to tell them. And he said unto my master, Peradventure the woman... Verse 39. And I said unto my master, Peradventure the woman will not follow me. And he said unto me, The Lord before whom I walk will send his angel with thee and prosper thy way. And thou shalt take a wife for my son of my kindred and of my father's house. Then shalt thou be clear from this my oath when thou comest to my kindred. And if they give not thee one, thou shalt be clear from my oath. If they won't give you a wife, if you can't get someone out of my kindred, then you're clear. If you can't get anyone to come with you. Verse 42, And I came this day unto the well and said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, if now thou do prosper my way which I go, behold, I stand by the well of water, and it shall come to pass that when the virgin cometh forth to draw water, and I say unto her, Give me, I pray thee, a little water of thy pitcher to drink, and she shall say unto me, Both drink thou, and I will also draw for thy camels. Let the same be the woman whom the Lord hath appointed out for my master's son. And before I had done speaking in my heart, behold, Rebekah came forth with her pitcher on her shoulder, and she went down unto the well and drew water. You notice, he was speaking in his heart. He didn't even utter these things aloud. And the most unlikely scenario immediately came to pass. And I said unto her, continuing in verse 45, Let me drink, I pray thee. 46, And she made haste, and let down her pitcher from her shoulder, and said, Drink, and I will give thy camels drink also. So I drank, and she made the camels drink also. And I asked her, and said, Whose daughter art thou? And she said, The daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bare unto him. And I put the earring upon her face, and the bracelets upon her hands. And I bowed down my head and worshipped the Lord and blessed the Lord God of my master Abraham, which hath led me in the right way to take my master's brother's daughter unto his son. So he's saying, I've come to take Rebekah here to be the wife of my master's son. Verse 49. He's made the proposition. Now, if you will deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me, and if not, tell me, that I may turn to the right hand or to the left. So he's laid out, you know, tell me or yes or no. So I can either go make my decision. I'll either go this way or that way. Tell me now. Because maybe I'm not going to stay for dinner. Are you passionate about the Lord? You know, that would be the question. Are you passionate about God? Do you read the Bible a lot? Tell me yes or no so I can keep talking to you, or go talk to somebody I'd rather talk to. What do you value most? You should ask those questions and then figure it out, and then don't waste your time. Verse 50. Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, The thing proceedeth from the Lord. We cannot speak unto thee bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before thee. Take her. And go, let her be thy master's son's wife, as the Lord hath spoken. We can't, you know, that's that we can't say bad or good. We can't approve of this or disapprove of it. I mean, God has spoken, no man can add to it. I can't say yes or no. God has spoken. It's the smartest thing they could have said. It's like, well, I guess so. God has spoken. Taking that into account, I suppose I'll add to that my approval. Verse 52. And it came to pass that when Abraham's servant heard their words, He worshipped the Lord, bowing himself to the earth. And the servant brought forth jewels of silver, and jewels of gold, and raiment, and gave them to Rebekah. He gave also to her brother and to her mother precious things. And they did eat and drink, he and the men that were with him, and tarried all night. And they rose up in the morning, and he said, Send me away unto my master. He wants to go right away the next day. It's asking a lot. Verse 55, and this is a natural response. And her brother and her mother said, Let the damsel abide with us a few days, at the least 10. After that she shall go. And he said unto them, Hinder me not. Seeing the Lord hath prospered my way, send me away that I may go to my master. So they've had the very natural inclination not to want to have such a hasty goodbye. Even though they've had her for years, it's like, you know, people always want to delay. And, I know that feeling because I remember when I had known my future wife just a very brief amount of time. Literally, it was about 75 days, which for Abraham's servant would have been an eternity. But I was 20 and Abraham is probably about 140 at this point. So he doesn't have much time. I had lots of time. But after about 75 days, I knew she was the one. Because I had been trying to rule her out right away. Instead of trying to say, is this person I could like? You might like them. You know, that's what people, they test the wrong thing. Do I like them? You gotta figure out right off the bat if you're gonna hate them. That's the question. Look for things you don't like first. It's so easy. When someone is just putting their best foot forward, that's what people do when they date. They put out their best face. They put on their best behavior. They hide all their faults. And everyone has faults. So faults is not something that really is such a, you know, it's tough to get someone to start discussing their faults right off the bat. And that's not what I'm really saying. I'm saying you talk about values. What's important to you? Because even if you've got faults, faults can be worked through. Everyone's going to have faults. There's going to be faults. But if your big values don't match up in a significant way, there's going to be problems. You will not be able to overcome the faults. It's because, you know, like if I value one thing and my spouse values another, those faults will drive a wedge between us. But if my wife and I, as we do, value the same things, those core values are going to draw us together in spite of any faults, as it has worked out. I knew right away I wanted to marry her, very early, before even the 75-day mark. 75-day mark is when I would have proposed to her if it wouldn't have seemed ridiculous, actually. But it only took me a couple. I was not able to, you know, every day I knew her where I couldn't rule her out, she just became the default choice. And so I was married in less than 9 months after meeting my future and current wife. You know, I met her and within 9 months we were married. Now, in this day and age, that's considered ridiculously fast. It is if you're not testing for core values. And that's what I was testing for. I was not initially thinking, is this a girl I'm going to date? I was asking the question, is this someone I should eliminate from my life? Is this someone I do not want to risk my future happiness on? Yeah, I mean, because when you just date someone and, oh, they're attractive and, oh, this might work out, you get all hopeful. You got to be pessimistic. This person could ruin my life. Who are they? What do they care about? This person could be an anchor dragging me down. People don't ask these questions. They instead start off with just hopeful, hopeful, hopeful. It's not the way you should approach the question. Because once you get tied in, you know, then you got kids. You better, you know, you got to stick by them and do them right. Children need both parents. It's the thing with this world today. They tell women they can do it on their own. And they do a terrible job. Because women don't know how to be men. Plain and simple. And men don't know how to be women. I don't think single fatherhood is any better than single motherhood. You know, it just doesn't provide the things the kid needs. They need both. I don't expect my wife to raise, to be me to the kids, and she didn't expect me to be her and to provide the things a mother provides. Okay. I'm getting off the track. But here we have an even quicker engagement. We have the one-hour engagement. You're the one. Because God made it plain. So they want her to stay. The servant wants to get going. Verse 57, and they said, we will call the damsel and inquire at her mouth. That was always the question. What if she won't come? 58, and they called Rebekah and said unto her, wilt thou go with this man? And she said, I will go. And they sent away Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant, and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said unto her, thou art our sister. Be thou the mother of thousands of millions, and let thy seed possess the gates of those which hate them. It's always good to possess your enemy's gates. You always are going to have haters. And to possess their gates is to have the total control over them. You know, that's the place of the in and out. That's the place of their economic activity. It's a metaphor for absolute domination. Dominate those that hate you. Beat them. Win. Nothing wrong with that. 61. And Rebekah arose and her damsels, and they rode upon the camels and followed the man. And the servant took Rebekah and went his way. It's interesting also the way they refer to this, you know, be the mother of thousands of millions. They had such a different outlook on childbearing, didn't they? You know, now it was presumed, be mother of millions. Because they understood this is a possibility. She was mother of millions. And for a time, her seed possessed the gate of those that hate them. I mean, in Israel, they possessed the gates of the Palestinians. That's true right now. Verse 61. And Rebekah arose and her damsels, and they rode upon the camels and followed the man, and the servant took Rebekah and went his way. So she has damsels. She also has maidservants. They're wealthy. They're with him. I mean, they are with her, these women, young ladies. And Isaac came from the way of the well, Lahairoi. That's the well of life and vision. For he dwelt in the south country. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field at eventide. He went out to the field to meditate. And he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, the camels were coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she lighted off the camel. For she had said unto the servant, what man is this that walketh in the field to meet us? And the servant had said, it is my master. Therefore she took a veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all things that he had done. And Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and took Rebekah, and she became his wife. And he loved her, and Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So she sees him, she puts the veil on her face. It's traditional for the bride to hide herself. We, even to this day, they have bridal veils and stuff. It was like, you know, a nice surprise. You hide her face till their wedding so that he would not see her. It creates mystery and anticipation. And that's fine. It's just a tradition. It's something that was probably of value to her. She did it. It's not like someone's like, put that veil on your face. Cover it up. She wasn't wearing it all the time up until now when she's going to meet her husband. Now she puts on the veil, which is kind of cute. Well, that concludes chapter 24 of the book of Genesis. We see how important it was in that society to have the right person as your wife. It is every bit as important in our society, especially if you want to have a happy life, if you want to be blessed of God, seek a spouse of the Lord. And this is painful, I know, for a lot of people. I've had friends who are desperate to get a wife. Desperate. But then they'd say things, and I think, like, you're not ready to just take, you're not ready to accept what the Lord wants to give you. You know what I mean? Like, the criteria is not quite straight up, necessarily, of what God has asked. That'll conclude our study in Genesis 24. This has been Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Stringini. Thank you for joining me. You can find all my studies on oraclesofgod.org, oraclesofgod.org. Thank you for joining me in this study, and I look forward to studying with you again very soon.